This is Tractor Tuesday Live, hosted by sixth-generation Nebraska farmer and Tractor Tuesday founder Zach Bosley and Scott Anderson, owner of New Age Ag Supply. Join them each week as they sit down with farmers, innovators, dealers, and creators who are enhancing the culture within agriculture, right here on Tractor Tuesday Live.
Hey, Zach Bosley here, Tractor Tuesday Live. We're actually on time while we're live. Joined here, like always, with Scott Anderson, New Age Ag Supply. And today, really fun one. We've got Don Freimiller in the house. Don, how's it going today out there?
It's going good. Hey, appreciate you reaching out to me.
Yeah, no, we're really excited. There's so much going on in the industry, from logistics and just, you know, every farmer anymore. You got to learn how to shift. We're all driving semi tractors now. And I think there's a lot of parallels of what's going on with agriculture is also happening in the trucking and logistics side. And I, you know, as we were talking briefly, you know, even my older brother, he's been working under 10 roads for, gosh, maybe a decade, 15 years. They've got a lot of postal routes. They're shutting up their shop here pretty soon. I think January 30th is their last day. And, you know, you see all this turmoil in the industry. I think it'll be a great episode for people to learn a little bit more about trucking. But most importantly, Don, I want to learn more about you. You know, growing up in Wisconsin, if you can tell me a little bit about your early life and then what happened as you began to transition from dairy and agriculture into the whole trucking business. So, yeah, if you don't mind, maybe just give everybody an introduction of who you are and where you're from, and we can get into more.
Okay, well, thank you, Zach. I was born in on a little farm, little dairy farm in southwestern Wisconsin. Mm. I was born in 1938, and my dad been farming and dairy farming all his life. And we went to school at a one room school out in the country, and actually where my dad went to school, and we he raised three of us kids there on this little 120 acre dairy farm. And then in about 1957, I graduated high school. And from there, I went directly out of high school into the Army, into active duty in the Army. And I did a short stint there. I got out in 1958.
Were you deployed anywhere, Don?
Pardon?
Were you deployed anywhere in the Army?
No, Korea, let's see, was just getting over, and a lot of the boys were coming home from Korea. So I was kind of right in the middle of that between Korea and Vietnam.
Sure.
And so I had never, I never got deployed out of the States. But while I was in the service, I got married. Basically 20 years old, and now I got a kid coming, and which happened right away. And but anyhow, I got home in 58, and Dad wrote me a letter while I was in the service and said, Don, now that you're married, I'll buy the farm next door to where we are, and you come, we got a house to live in, and we'll run these two farms together. And I said, Dad, don't think I'm coming home on the farm. And I went, and of course, I had to get a job right away. And I got a job in a cheese factory in Stitzer, Wisconsin, making cheese, driving a milk truck. And then Dubuque Packing Company in Dubuque, Iowa. Maybe you've heard of Dubuque Meats in Dubuque, Iowa. They started a night hog kill. And so I got hired on the night hog kill in Dubuque, which was a big deal because I went from $225 a month wages working 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, to $1.59 an hour, mm-hmm. popping kidneys out of the back fat of a hog. Okay. So So I worked there. While I'm working there at the Dubuque Packing Company, I rented a 120 acre, a little over 120 acres, a dairy farm. So I was working nights. So I started having a milking. We was milking 30 cows. During the day, I'd do the dairy farm, and my wife would finish up the milking at night when I had to go to work. And I worked there for 6 years. Mm. And I had transferred down to the shipping dock, got to know people in shipping. And but then they did a layoff. And that layoff went back a long ways. It was a big layoff. And so I didn't know what I was going to do, because now my fourth child is on the way. And so I rented over in Darlington, Wisconsin, I rented a 460 acre dairy farm, and I moved that little dairy farm to that farm in Darlington, Wisconsin. And there I was milking like 62 cows, and we were feeding out some hogs, and I had an FHA loan for the cattle and equipment and the farm equipment I needed. And of course, in the wintertime, the cows would dry up and the milk check got really small. And because they took the payment out of the loan out of my milk check, and I didn't know quite how I was going to keep the lights on and feed four kids.
Yeah.
And so then I heard about this trucker over in Shelbyville, Wisconsin, that needed a part-time driver to haul his hogs out of the Cudahy stockyards to Milwaukee Packing House. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go over and see him. And I said, I understand you could use a part-time driver at night to run these hogs to Milwaukee. He said, yes. He said, have you ever drove tractor trailer? And I said, well, yes. And I lied through my teeth because I never drove one in my life. He said, good, we'll be here at 7 o'clock tonight. Take this load of hogs to Milwaukee.
Okay.
So anyhow, I did, got it done. Of course, I didn't back in too good to the chutes because I never backed one up before. But anyhow, we got it in and got hogs unloaded, and I got home. And so I did that part time during the winter, until the cows started calving and, you know, the milk check got bigger and things got good. But anyhow, that's how was my initiation into 18-wheelers and tractor trailers.
How many hours a week were you working? You must have been sleeping like 4 hours a night or so.
Yeah, it was a little on the short side. We'd get up about 6 a.m. to milk, and I wouldn't get home to about 3 o'clock in the morning. So I get myself about three and a half hours sleep. But I only did that maybe three times a week or sometime. But it gave me enough cash to keep the lights on and feed the kids until the milk checks got bigger. It was, and my wife worked really hard. She'd finish up the utensils at night and put the milking machines. Back then we were using surge. I don't know if you remember surge buckets to milk with. But
yeah, a lot of legwork and just even, you know, but hopefully this time you're still in your 20s, I presume.
I'm in my 20s, just getting into my 30s, yeah. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that was in 1964.
Okay.
That I moved on that 400-acre farm. Okay.
Yeah.
My youngest son was born. I think, Scott, you've met David.
Yep.
And that, if I can brag a little bit, you know, I had four children. And, of course, now I'm driving this truck at night. And in 1968, the guy decided that I was driving for, and he wanted to sell the company, and he was going to get out of hauling these hogs. Hmm. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll buy it. So I went to a bank in East Dubuque, Illinois, and believe it or not, he loaned me the money to buy that truck I was driving and a couple of little straight trucks that we picked the hogs up from the farmers and to the stockyards. And so in March of 1968, I was now a cattle trucker.
Okay.
And on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And but to brag about the kids, ever since 1968, they were just little tots. And in school, in high school, they have come and worked, and I gave them a job in the company. And they never went to college, by fault, I guess. But today, here we are all these years later, and them four kids are running this company, and they've never ever worked anywhere else in their life.
Yeah.
Outside of Kevin Anderson, I don't know anybody else that's had all their children be able to do that. So I'm just proud of that.
Well, and we had a comment just come in and just says living the dream, you know, and it really is, because there's so many ways to get confused and trying to find your way forward. You know, not everybody has that situation that they've established something, and you know, all four is just such a 100%, just such a home run. Even to keep one or two back, to keep them in a family business, is quite impressive. So yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And I brag about that all the time. I've just been a blessed man to have that, because they did nothing but work there since high school. They're, each one of the kids have their own departments, but anyhow, I'll get back to that. But so anyhow, everything was going good, and I'm picking hogs up, and I've now grown. I've bought myself a possum belly. I think most people know what a possum belly cattle trailer is. And I started hauling cattle for the farmers to Chicago stockyards, to Cedar Rapids, to Waterloo. I expanded the cattle business. And then I guess, Scott, I'll tell about the stockyards, how one day the buyer at the Cudahy Stockyards in Shellsburg decided he wasn't going to buy hogs anymore. So I thought, what am I going to do? I mean, this 5 days a week and this trucking these hogs in Milwaukee was kind of my bread and butter. And so I went to Milwaukee and I met with Cudahy Packing. And I said, I'd like to be the buyer at the stockyards. And they said, well, yeah, we'll set you up. We'd do the buyer. And then they said, well, you know, you got to buy with your own money. Oh, man, I got to buy these hogs with my own money. Yeah. So I thought about that a little bit. And I thought, well, you know, there's a thing out there called the Packers and Stockyard Act that's been in around for a long time. They can't kill any hogs or any cattle unless they own it and they're paid for. So that means they have to overnight transfer the money when I delivered all of the hogs to them to a bank.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know, I'd make this work. So I went over to East Dubuque, Illinois, and where my banker was. I put $100 in the account, and I went home and I started buying hogs. Anyhow, things went real good. And I thought, you know, I better drive these loads of hogs myself to Milwaukee, because I don't want anything to happen. So I did that for, I don't know, 5-6 months. Pretty soon, believe it or not, it got to where it was my own money that I was working on. But the float worked real good for about 6 months to get me on my feet. And anyhow, the banker thought, man, what's this guy doing? This checking account just grown like leaps and bounds. But that let me expand and buy more trucks. And anyhow, that's my livestock hauling experience. And then about 1970, somebody came to me and said, you know, the rates on produce out of California is really, really good. So I looked at it a little bit, and I've never been to California. And I thought, okay, maybe I'll buy a reefer trailer, a refrigerated trailer. And again, the banker came through for me, and I bought a new tractor. And, well, no, I used my new one I had in the livestock. I'm getting ahead of myself. But anyhow, June 17, 1970, I called Dubuque Packing Company. I said, how are you getting your meat to California? They said, well, we're using a company called Little Audrey out of Fremont, Nebraska. Mm. And so I called them and I said, how would you like to have a brand new tractor and trailer trip leasing to you? Now, we're back in the regulated days. Now, I'll touch a little more on the regulation of the difference, because I don't know if a lot of the younger people understand what regulation is.
No.
So anyhow, I told my first June 17, 1970, I hauled for my first load of meat out of Dubuque Packing Company to South San Francisco. And that was the first load. And then I got to where that year I bought a second one hauling meat to California out of Dubuque. Again, trip leasing the Little Audrey because I didn't have the operating authority. But I would haul produce out of California back to Jewel. I don't remember Jewel T in Chicago, a big chain store. I'd haul produce out of California back to them in Chicago. And then, of course, we did head back up to Dubuque, get another load of meat. Well, produce is an exempt commodity, just like cattle is. You know, any unmanufactured agriculture product was exempt from regulation. So I would trip lease going west, come back going east on my own authority.
What's a trip lease, Don?
Trip leases was I had to give them a percentage and they set the rates. Because of the regulation, it was regulated, you know, and maybe to explain what regulation is. Regulation started with the Interstate Commerce Commission. You've heard of the Interstate Commerce Commission, mm-hmm. Right? Well, in 1893, I think, the Interstate Commerce Commission was set up because of the railroads. And back then, the railroads was now hauling freight for other people, companies across state lines. So it was a way of regulating the railroad. And the laws were set up about whose liability was what and what you had to have and insurance and all this sort of thing. But, and that happened in, I think it was 1893. About that time along, they also passed what they call the Carmack Act. And the Carmack Act was brought and put in place that in case the railroad killed somebody and it had their load of freight on, the shipper wouldn't be responsible or liable for lawsuits or for any liability. Yeah. Well, that was back then. And of course, then in 1938, trucks started getting involved moving freight across the United States and from state to state. So they expanded in 1938, they expanded the Carmack rule and ICC regulation into trucking, with the same requirements that the shipper wouldn't be responsible if we killed somebody, and on for liability and the cargo that you had to have insurance and all that. That was all set up back in 1938, for trucking. Hmm. I don't know. And of course that was a long time ago. Well, that went on to the point that the Interstate Commerce Commission regulated trucking so to the point that you had to have this ICC number on your truck, and you had to have operating authority that, because they only granted operating authority to certain carriers. You had to apply for it. You had to prove that there was a necessity for it. And you then would get your number. Well, back then, it really only certain people would get this operating authority. Well, back then there was, I have to look here, there's a, in 1938, it was just a handful of carriers. In other words, they let one carrier do meet Dubuque, Iowa to California. Well, that was Little Audrey out of Fremont, Nebraska, had that operating authority.
Okay.
But instead of me leasing to them full time, I only leased to them one way. And that's why they called it just a trip lease.
I see.
Okay.
It kind of sounds like the taxi medallions, that the, how that used to work before Uber came up and changed that all around.
Yeah, kind of the same. Like if you wanted to get I was operating around 1975. I applied for my first piece of operating authority. I wanted to haul cheese out of Wisconsin to California, to Los Angeles. And we got, now companies that had that authority, like Perkle did in Wisconsin, that's an old truck line up there. They had the cheese authority to California. Well, I wanted to get in the game because I had a shipper that wanted me to haul his cheese. So I applied for an authority, and of course, all these other trucking companies protested the authority, and I kept getting beat down. And I'd go to court again, and I'd get beat down. And Perkle and all these other five or six carriers said, no, we don't need another carrier in here. We can have it. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I need a different attorney. Back then, there was a lot of ICC attorneys. And by the way, which a lot of them people end up owning trucking companies. Mm-hmm. I'll just mention one. He was a real good friend of mine, Dwayne Ackley, out of Lincoln, Nebraska. He was an ICC attorney, and he ended up owning Creek Carriers and Sunflower, mm-hmm. and you may have seen all them. He ran a really great. Well, he put me on to a attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, and man, he was an expensive back then. So I went to Atlanta, Georgia, and man, here's this little farm boy in this peach tree tower, going up to see this high dollar attorney, right? And I can't remember his name. I got in his office, told him I had shipper support, and I had Norwalk Cheese was going to support me, and on and on. And I told him the story and how I got beat down. He got up from his desk and he came over, and big old tall guy. And I remember him putting his arm around my shoulder, and he said, in his southern drawl, "Son, we just gonna get you that authority." Anyhow, he went on it, and we went all the way. They got protested me all the way till we had an oral hearing in Los Angeles. And Perkle, they sent in their attorneys from Chicago, and FFE sent in their attorneys, and here I am, my big tall guy from Atlanta, he's there, and my wife is sitting there with me. And anyhow, this my southern my Southern attorney, he just chewing them up and he's spitting them out. And my wife was sitting there and she said, "Don't you feel sorry for them people? Here, if you knew what this was costing, you wouldn't be saying that."
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah, got them going.
That was my first piece of ICC operating authority.
Okay.
Were you still milking at this time?
Pardon?
Were you still milking on the dairy?
No. I eliminated that. I had a farm sale once I got up to three trucks. In 1969, I was trying to farm and I'm running three or four tractor trailers and it just didn't work. I mean, something had to go and I had a farm auction.
Okay.
And the auctions, they came in and sold all the dairy, sold all my dairy cows, all my farm equipment, all the machinery, you know, farm sale. I worked all them years and I think I, when it was all done, the auction company gave me $10,000. That's what I had to. And I made a down payment on a little motel and a house in Shelbyville, Wisconsin. Hmm. And that's where we started, was starting a trucking company.
I see.
Okay. So that's how I went from farming to trucking full time.
Okay.
But anyhow, now I got my first piece of operating authority under the regulations. And from then on, I went and I got Oscar Mayer in Madison, Wisconsin to support me. I got, of course, Dubuque Packing Company supported me, Rath in Waterloo, Wilson in Cedar Rapids. They all supported me. So that's how I grew to be a meat hauler, you might say. That was my big.
So you transitioned from live animals to full refrigerated trailers at this point?
Yeah, well, I found it was a whole lot easier to haul it in a box than on the hoof. Didn't have to clean them trailers out with the scoop and the shovel in the middle of the night and them cattle trailers, but you know, it was, but yeah. So now I think in 73, I sold the cattle trucks.
Okay.
By that time I had three drop centers, cattle trailers and you know, we were still picking up hogs from the farm. And I got out of the hog buying business in 73 also.
Okay.
I was also in the cattle. I was able to buy cattle I buy canners and cutters for Oscar Mayer.
Hmm.
And then I would truck them.
Okay.
So that, but then I got all that went away in 73. So I was ahead of my story there, but good question. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now I'm trucking full time, doing meat, produce to Chicago, and I'm up to 56 trucks in 1980. And 1980 was a year of deregulation. If you remember, Jimmy Carter deregulated the industry. Well, all this authority thing that I told you about all went out the window.
Okay.
Crazy, yeah.
All the money we spent on these attorneys and all, and by the way, we used to have to carry all the expenses with these attorneys as an asset on our balance sheet, because operating authority was an asset that you could sell.
Okay.
Well, 1980, that all gone away, deregulated. Well, that let anybody that wanted to get into the industry. Matter of fact, in 1980, and I may get these numbers, I got a note here. I think I got it right, that there was like 18, there was roughly 18,000 trucking companies in the United States, basically in 1980 when they deregulated. Mm-hmm. By the year 2000, by the year 2000, mm-hmm. there were roughly 500,000.
Wow.
DOT numbers and people in the trucking industry. Mm. What that did was it drove the freight rates down at a time that interest was going to 20%, if you remember, 20% interest. Back then there was a fuel shortage. Also, it drove driver wages down. It let brokers get into the business, and so brokers started, you see them, freight brokers.
Yeah.
And they got exempted just like the shippers did under the Carmack Act.
Okay.
And so shippers had the same, or brokers had the same exemptions as shippers.
Hmm.
So it really, trucking was really went through a huge downturn in 1980. A lot of the unionized companies, because of that, never made it in the industry. If you remember the consolidated CFs, Freightways, PIEs, Ringsby, all them big carriers that were unionized, they all went under. And it was basically because of the deregulation and the downturn in trucking.
Yeah.
We survived that barely in 1980. And of course, not being the smartest or the sharpest knife in the drawer, about the same year I moved to Bakersfield, California, because I needed to be on one end or the other. Shelbyville, Wisconsin, I had a deadhead 100 miles just to find an interstate.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're hauling produce. Like, I'm going to haul produce all my life going east.
Yeah.
And by going to Bakersfield, that put me in the middle of the produce. You know, the produce ran from Bakersfield north in the summer, Bakersfield south in the winter. And it hooked me right up to so anyhow, I thought that was a good move. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. But that was in 1980, and I had 56 trucks.
Okay.
But now I'm hauling for a lot of the big companies. To fast forward, Bakersfield was really good. I grew the company from 56 to 1994. I had 802 trucks.
Wow.
Amazing. And
we were one of the top refrigerated carriers in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
But California decided that they didn't like me self-insuring my work comp and my liability that I had all set up in 47 of the 48 states.
Hmm.
And California said, nah, your corporate headquarters are here. We need you to pay into the state work comp fund, and we don't care if you hire a driver in Maine. And now I've got terminals set up around the country where I'm hiring drivers other than California. And they said, you got to pay into the work comp here, state fund.
Okay.
Well, I had the politicians in Bakersfield and state politicians in Bakersfield. We went to Sacramento, and we tried to say, well, you can put a deposit down, or I agreed to put a deposit down to the state so they would let me self-insure. And by the way, when I say self-insured, it was through an offshore captive. And I think you've all heard of offshore captive companies.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
I remember going to Sacramento with these politicians, and we're sitting in a meeting, and a young guy said, okay, well, you'll put a deposit down. I said, yep. I said, you just tell me, what is the deposit you think you'd like? Well, he was kind of being a smart butt, and he said, $1 million. And I said, oh, yeah, $1 million. I said, okay, where do I write the check? And the guy went, oh, my, and he started to swallow. And they backtracked all the way. And because I knew that that was a lot cheaper than moving the company.
Yeah.
And anyhow, they said, no, as long as you're there, you're going to pay into state fund. They took my work comp rate from $5 a hundred to $25 a hundred.
Jeez.
So I was either out of business, shut it down, or operate till you're broke.
Yeah.
So anyhow, that's why we moved to Oklahoma City, and that happened in 1994.
Okay.
When did you go public with Fry Miller Trucking?
I went public in 1987. We were running probably five, 600 trucks. You know, and I'm going to tell you, you know, I've made some mistakes in my life, and some big ones. Number one, the first mistake I made, of course, moving to California, which I didn't know, but I thought it was a good idea. Number two was going public. I went public for, I was too small. I did it for all the wrong reasons at all the wrong time. And it was not the right thing for me to do. All that cash looked good at the time, but it didn't work out. It was not the right thing for me to do. I just did it for the wrong reasons. And that was my second big mistake that I made, I guess. And I'll get to the third one down the road, but all these mistakes did cost money. I mean, it was just part of growing.
To jump in, Don, you know, when you went public then, did you lose the majority of the control of what you'd built over the years, or what were the negatives, I guess, from your company going public?
Well, one of the negatives, I still had 58% of the stock.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then I had to put on a board of directors, and I picked a board that really didn't understand trucking.
Mm.
And trucking's kind of an animal, but I had an attorney, and I had a newspaper guy. I don't know. I had some supposed to be prominent people there in Bakersfield, but anyhow, I didn't pick the right board.
Yeah.
But yes, I lost some control. The analysts would come in, you know, and they'd tell you, do this, do this, do this. But I remember, you probably all heard of Clarence Warner out of Omaha, Nebraska, Warner Trucking.
Yes.
He was a mentor to me. He was, over the years, he only had 100 trucks when I first knew him. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of my mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he'd went public years before. And he said, Don, when them analysts come in, he said, you grab them by the seat of their pants and their shirt collar and you march them to the door. Well, I didn't do that because I thought, hey, these guys are college educated. They're smart. They know more about this than this old farm boy does. And I listened to the analysts more than I should have, which that didn't help me. So that was another negative that I had. Besides, I was not, believe it or not, I'm not a, how would I say it? I'm not a Wall Street type guy. My thinking's different. And I actually listened to them, and I layered on more debt than I should have, because their whole deal was grow. And that's how, of course, we got the 802 trucks. But that would all worked out too had I had not had to move from Bakersfield to Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. Very, very costly.
Yeah.
So we had some tough times there. And make a long story short, in 1995, I'll get the date. I had a line of credit on the receivables with a bank in Minneapolis, Minnesota called Norwest Bank. Mm-hmm. And of course, we spent around $5 million doing this move. We're about $100 million in revenue in size back then. And it was a tough, tough move. And it was the only year, and I believe my accountant was Arthur Anderson. And I remember that because our friend Scott, that comes to your Steam shows, he's from Oklahoma, Jeff Detweiler.
Jeff Detweiler, yep.
He was with Arthur Anderson. Anyhow, he kind of knows the story. And so Arthur Anderson put a going concern on the end of my financial statement. And that was a broken covenant that I had with Norwest Bank. So Norwest Bank, now got to remind, I'm not 30 days late on a payment. All my accounts payable are current. I'm current everywhere. As a matter of fact, I got the company after the move. I got the company turning black ink. And the only year we lost money was the year to move. In all the years I was trucking, that's the only year we lost money. But they put that going concern on. And so Norwest Bank seen a way to come in, and they're going to show up and with their lawyers, and they're coming in to, which I figured they're going to shut me down. And well, that's the same day that McFay blew up the Murray building, the federal building in Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
That they were showing up.
Wow.
And it blew my attorney and it blew the judge across the courtroom. And so they postponed it. Norwest went back home, and I was in the middle of filing a Chapter 11 reorganization is the reason they were in the courtroom, okay? The judge took it home, signed the pages, we filed reorganization. And about 12 months later, there was a company came to me out of Fort Worth, Texas, and he just did a $100 million junk bond offering with Smith Barney. And he said, we're out going to buy trucking companies, and we're going to consolidate 10 or 12 trucking companies. And he did. And I sold the public company to Ameritruck, was the name of it, out of Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay.
I was going to go do something else. And my youngest son, David, said, Dad, all you ever taught us kids was trucking. He said, we want to go trucking again. Well, I seen that Ameritruck wasn't going to make it because they bought 10 trucking companies. And they did the same thing as they did to me, to all 10 of them. The owner of Ameritruck come in one day and said, Don, I see you have no formal education of any kind. And he said, and I've got a PhD in business. And he said, you got a couple hours, get your stuff out of the office. Now I got a contract, I got stock, which was stupid of me, but then I got a whole bunch. And so next day, fired off four of my kids. And so then that's when now we're out, okay? And of course, he took the name Freimiller off everything and put Ameritruck on. He bought, remember Mofford out of Colorado? He bought that company. He bought 10 other companies.
Okay.
Well, in three years, he bankrupted all 10 of them trucking companies and went through the $100 million.
Wow.
And I seen what was happening. So David said, hey, let's go trucking again. So I had five tractors and David had five tractors. We put them together. We had 10 tractors. So in 1996, he and I started with 10 trucks and $20,000. And what you see today is from the growth of that.
Wow.
Meanwhile, I had to get my name back in 96. So I seen them going under. So I had sued them. And part of the settlement was, hey, and I won this deal. I took 10 cents on a dollar, but give me my name and logo back. So we put the name and logo on when Dave and I got going a little bit. And of course, things just went back. Well, you see where we are today.
Yeah.
But anyhow, that was a tough period in my life. I learned a lot, but selling to Ameritruck probably was my third, because I could have survived. I could have got through without doing the reorganization.
Mm-hmm.
But Norwest would not take that going concern off of my statement and being public. It was a problem.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say going public was my third largest mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we make a few mistakes, but nothing like them ones. Like mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty amazing here. You built all that up over all those years, you sell, and then eventually it all swings back around and you're able to buy the name and the brand back and then build it, you know, back into where you guys are today. And, you know, I'm a little bit ignorant, obviously very familiar with the brand and the name, but in comparison, how many trucks are you guys running currently?
I believe we're around 750 some tractors.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's somewhere between 11 and 1200 trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started 25 years ago, we started a used truck dealership called Heartland Truck Sales.
Mm-hmm.
And that's did very good for us too. And that's been a good, cause we run pretty new equipment. We turn our trucks at about 400,000 miles.
Okay.
And then we move them over to Heartland and we bring it. And that's worked for us over the years.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's kind of where Freimiller. And but then maybe going back to deregulation and the entry of people coming into the entry, that all really worked okay until Obama became president. I don't know what years that was now.
Must have been around 2009. He probably stepped into the White House. I think it was the 2008 election.
Yeah, 2008. Yeah.
And if you remember, he came out with the H-2B visas and the H-3B visas. Okay. One was for agriculture workers.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was for any other workers. Well, we started to get a few immigrants coming into our industry and get into trucking. But that was fine. They came in legally. They were under the visas, and most of them were coming out of South America. They could speak English. They could. they could operate equipment. They were trucking down there, but that's where the immigrant thing started, is back in the Bauman area.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, 5 years ago, I don't have to tell you what happened. The gate swung open, and well, they come in by the millions and millions. Yeah. And they didn't bother about getting visas. They didn't bother about getting legal. They didn't bother about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them got into the trucking industry. Mm-hmm. So the last 4 years, 5 years have been really tough for trucking.
Yeah.
It has put a lot of third generation smaller fleets out of business. I mean, the bankruptcies in trucking right now are higher than they've ever been.
Yeah.
And you said your brother drove for 10. Actually, that was caused, that bankruptcy or that going out of, I don't think they filed bankruptcy. I think they just shut it down.
Yeah.
Was actually caused because of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And what the federal government did is decided they could use brokers cheaper than giving the freight to people like System 10. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on in everything. I mean, in dry vans and the reefers and today they say there's 660,000 illegals out there driving truck.
Wow.
And there's 3.3 million truck drivers.
Mm.
It means that 18 to 20% of our drivers out there are illegals.
Yeah.
The wow. bulk of them don't have proper CDLs. Biggest share of them can't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
Biggest share of them can't read road signs. Biggest share of them got their CDLs through some CDL mill that's been set up by illegals. They don't carry proper licensing. They don't carry insurance. None of them carry FISDAM insurance.
Mm.
Because their trucks are not financed through American finance companies won't finance these people.
Mm-hmm.
So the cartel money comes in and finances these trucks, and they're paid for it. They don't have a lien on them, so they don't carry FISDAM insurance. Mm. So when they lay one over in the highway, the record companies don't want to move them, don't want to get them off the road because they can't get paid. And so the states end up picking up the tow bills, the record bills.
Mm.
And I happen to know that because for 7 years now, I've been a commissioner on Oklahoma Department of Transportation, on ODOT.
Yeah,
I see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's turned into a nightmare that it's starting to take hold. We now have a man by the name of Sean Duffy as our Secretary of Transportation, and he's well aware of it, and our president's well aware of it, and so they are starting to shut him down, and they're bringing him down. The state of California was probably the biggest culprit in it. I see that the governor of that state said, hey, we're going to let these 17,000 immigrants that their CDLs aren't valid be valid. I don't know how he's doing that.
Wow.
But the safety aspect out there, and the news media has picked up, you've seen they're killing people. I'm watching Oklahoma because I'm on the commission and I have an interest, but Oklahoma right now, not to even bring this up or probably shouldn't, but it's the fifth highest in the nation in commercial vehicle fatalities.
Wow.
And it's being done by the illegals.
Mm.
Because Oklahoma is a bridge state. In other words, I-40, I-35, east-west traffic is a bridge state. So they're all crossing
Yeah.
Oklahoma.
Mm.
or a lot.
Yeah, a lot of more. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's now ICE and the Oklahoma State Patrol. They're starting to shut them down, and they're doing catching them and putting them on buses and shipping them out of here. But I don't think this thing's going to turn until maybe the middle of 2026. Maybe it'll get better. Meanwhile, I feel bad for a lot of these third generations and people like the company your brother worked for.
Mm-hmm.
That's all caused by illegals and brokers.
Yeah.
And then let me tell you about how the brokers, I hate to get carry on here. Am I going on?
Oh, no, this is great. Now, Don, you got a lot of insight. We appreciate all the knowledge here you're sharing with the audience.
Okay, well, brokers, remember I talked about the Carmack Act and mm-hmm. exempted the shipper?
Yeah.
Well, the Carmack Act exempted the brokers. So the brokers out there grew by topsy.
Okay.
Huge. You got big ones out there today, like C.H. Robinson. You've heard that name.
Yeah.
They're up in the $20 billion of revenue, something like that.
Wow.
They don't care who they hire to haul these loads. Mm-hmm. They get this guy really, really cheap. And guess what? The broker hasn't gotten any liability. So they hired this guy that can't speak English, can't read road signs, but he'll haul this load of freight from a broker real cheap. And the broker, you can't go back and sue the broker because they're protected under the Carmack Act. Mm. That needs to change. And there is a case right now before the Supreme Court. I think it was the seventh court ruled in favor of the C.H. Robinson. And so they took it to the Supreme Court. I believe the Supreme Court is hearing it.
Mm.
And we're expecting a decision on that somewhere in June, July of 2026.
Okay.
If that court rules that the brokers have liability and exempt them away from the Carmack Act, it would be a hockey stick. Trucking would go good again, and companies like your brother's would have never been out of business or closed down because the brokers were taking all these postal deals and they don't care who they hired because we can't get sued.
Yeah.
That needs to change. I'm a pure, if I can be sued because I hire an unsafe driver, why shouldn't that brokerage be sued because he hired an unsafe driver?
Right.
That's my philosophy. And that's just me, for whatever that's worth. But I'm thinking maybe by the middle of this year, we'll get enough of these illegals off the road. We get the Supreme Court, hopefully,
mm-hmm.
rule against C.H. Robinson. And by the way, they're not going to like me saying this, but I don't care. They need to play by the same rules and regulations that us asset boys need to play with.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that's my opinion, and whether it's right or wrong, but
Don, there was a trucker that I hired recently. He was driving a hot shot, but he told me that he's been getting stopped at the, when he drove through Oklahoma last time, he got stopped at the way station, and they made him read like a very plain English, text, like see Jane run, see Spot run, like kindergarten, first grade level reading. They made him read that to determine if he could read English. And he said, the officer said that anybody who can't read that, they immediately impound the truck and take the guy's CDL away. Wow. So they are, I know Oklahoma has cracked down. And I heard recently from a guy you probably know, I just met him 2 days ago. He bought my Indian motorcycle that I had for sale. His name is Bob Kimball over in Nuevo. He said that he actually financed some of your trucks when you were in Bakersfield with a company that he had called Sunburst Leasing. When you were financing owner operators, you remember him?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I met him 2 days ago.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
I met him 2 days ago. Dad and I drove over with that motorcycle. And he said that he sells about 150 to 170 new titles every month. He sells used trailers and trucks. He does a huge business. Most all dry van box trucks. And so he said that he used to have guys that would pull in the yard, can't speak a lick of English, that, you know, they had the headdress on and everything. And he said now recently he hasn't seen any guys like that in California. So I don't know if California is getting cracking down some or if you've heard that or not.
I have not heard that, but I know that it's taken effect. I'm also reading and understanding that they believe there's going to be a truck shortage or capacity shortage by the middle of the year. I can't wait for it to come. I got four kids there still doing. I'm cashed out. I'm out of the company. I'm retired. The kids are doing it. My one son still has ownership in it. I guess, you know, a private equity company came in and bought us about 3 years ago. Okay. And, but my youngest son still has 30%. David has 30%. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
But all four kids are still there running it, working it. Although they're starting to think about retiring.
How old are your kids, Don?
Pardon?
How old are your kids?
Dennis is 67. And Dennis heads up sales and marketing. Diane, she runs the accounting, receivable, the credit department, the billing department. She is 66. And Denise, who actually she sits outside of David's office. They call her the guard dog for David. But anyhow, she manages all the real estate holdings and accessorial companies and other stuff that we have. I still talk like I, but anyhow, she does that, and she does operations. If a driver has a problem, they call her because she's really sharp operations. And then there's David, who he loves maintenance and he loves the equipment. He's really sharp. He's a gearhead. But he's a real good manager. I mean, David's a way better trucker. Well, all the kids are a way better trucker than I ever was. They've took this thing further and better, and they've just did a whole lot better job than I could have ever done. So I'm proud of what they're doing. But Denise, that was Diane. Diane's birthday is today, now to think about it. Hmm. She will be 63 or 64, and then David's 61. I think it'd be 62 in May.
So do you have any grandchildren in the business then too, Don?
I have one grandson that is working there. He's helping Denise.
Okay.
I have 8 grandchildren, and I have 5 great-grandchildren.
Wow.
But rest of them are all married, and they're out on their own. And but only one of them. So I don't, and that's another reason we kind of went third to an equity company. The timing was right. You know, 3 years ago, trucking was still pretty good. And
yeah.
And the, I didn't see a third generation coming in to keep it going.
Yeah.
So I'm sure over the years, you probably have countless crazy stories. But I remember there's a few bottles of whiskey in your or David's office sitting around. Can you tell that story?
You get me laughing here. Yeah. Excuse me.
Oh,
yeah, there is five bottles of Jack Daniel's sitting on top of the cadenza of David's in David's office. And we had a truck load in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, a load of Jack Daniel's headed for Oklahoma City. And the truck, the drivers decided the truck wasn't running right. They took it into a Freightliner shop in Memphis, Tennessee. And they dropped the trailer and took the tractor into the shop. And of course, during the evening, the trailer disappeared. And then they called the ATF, got involved, the alcohol, tobacco, firearm. They get involved because it's liquor. And they went hunting for the trailer. And actually, 3-4 days later, we found the trailer. Trailer was empty, except for one broken case. There was five bottles of good Jack Daniels left. And ATF says, you can have the five bottles of Jack Daniels, but we want the case that came in. Okay. Don't know what that was. So we took the bottle. So anyhow, the distributor that we were hauling this load to, now he's got to wait for the insurance money. And it was, I believe, $136,000 or $156,000 for that load. Mm. And he was a little distributor. And now he's in hurt because the distributors can't get credit on liquor. They have to pay cash up front. And he ordered another load, but now he needed more cash to order that load. So went into David's office and said, Dave, maybe we ought to just write this distributor a check so he can buy this next load. Well, the insurance money's coming. And so David gave him a check. And anyhow, I got one big bottle of wine out of it.
Okay.
From the distributor. But them five bottles still sit in David's office.
Yeah, it's pretty funny there. But hey, we got one question that came in off of Facebook, it looks like. But, you know, it seemed like a few years back, there was a real big push for driverless autonomous semi-tractors in particular. You know, a lot of that chatter seems like it's really been dialed back now. But what are your thoughts, Don, with all these electric trucks that are allegedly coming to market, to production? What are you seeing in the industry, and is there any reality there, or is it just a lot of hype?
I believe there's probably more hype than there is reality to it right now. And my way of explaining it is this, and Scott, you're a pilot. Airplanes could actually fly themselves. You don't need pilots in an airplane to fly an airplane today. You can land one, take off with one, right? Airplanes can fly themselves. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you got to have a pilot in there, right? And the general public ain't going to get in that airplane if there ain't a pilot in there.
Right.
I think the general public's going to really allow 18-wheelers to be up and down a highway out there without a pilot in the seat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think productivity will increase because you'll be able to run them around the clock. I think costs can be drove down by them.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's positives, but to think you're going to see one someday, and I know they're out there testing doing that, but in my mind, there'll always be a driver in that seat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, one day, Wolfgang was making a joke about the AI stuff, and he said, "One day you're going to be able to get in your motor coach, John, go in the back and take a nap, and wake up in California from Oklahoma. It'll just drive itself one day."
Well, we're watching automobiles today. There's a friend drive here into the resort where I am, and he picked up a friend of mine, and he said, "Watch this." And they headed for the sandbar to go eat. And the guy never touched the steering wheel all the way to the sandbar.
Yeah.
So it's coming, and I think it's, but I just don't think I'll never be alive to see it. And I don't, where there is not going to be a pilot in that truck.
Yeah.
And if they do this, it's going to be point to point.
Mm-hmm.
What you're going to see is, like, we're going to go from Oklahoma to California. Somewhere there's going to be a drop point in a yard, assembly yard that they're going to go in and out of. It's not going to take it the last 2 miles or 3 miles.
Yeah.
That'll be done by other companies.
Okay.
And there's companies out there now called the last mile and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And we're seeing it in agriculture as well. Obviously these autonomous tractors sounds great, but ultimately they got to keep a few of us alive to polish the robots. So I think that's the one advantage here. We got a little bit of intelligence to keep it pushing,
somebody's got to wax the robot.
Yeah. Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. I believe I was talking to one of the Anderson boys one day, and they said something about we'd read a book between both ends of the field or something. Was that you, Scott? I don't know.
Yeah, probably me. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds like something they'd do. My equipment's too beat up. I can't read a book. I got to look at every little inch while it's, running on its own on GPS to make sure I can find the next breakdown. But a little bit different of an operation down here. But Don, currently with Freimiller, I guess what's the big purpose? What's the mission right now with the next generation in charge? Are the ethos the same? Is everything as, was created again, I guess, on the second iteration from the 90s? What's the goals?
Well, my goal is a selfish goal, I guess. When you put me in a box, I still would love to know that there's Freimiller trucks running up and down the American highways.
Yeah.
I guess I have a little bit of ego to, in my mind that, hey, I feel good when I see one of them going down the road, and I'd like that to continue. It's been out there for 58 years.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know. My son thinks it will. I don't know what these equity companies want to do, but a lot of times they don't hang on to things very long.
Yeah.
I really don't know. But I brought that up to my son, and I said, he said, "Dad, everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine, Dad." So, you know what? They did this far. I think everything's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Well, you guys are putting on what did you say, 8 million miles a week or something like that?
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, we do about 8 million miles a month.
A month.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So there's about 700 and some trucks you're running now.
I believe last count I seen, it was 750 something.
Wow.
And then our drivers were pretty full. I believe the last time I looked, and by the way, I still get daily operational reports. They've never stopped. I still have an office in the company. I still have a company phone. They give me little perks. And so I'm still pretending I'm in trucking, I guess.
Yeah.
But the thing that I do, my biggest job is 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I get a thing across the email that says the driver's name, his age, birthday, how long he's been with me, and a phone number, and I call him and say happy birthday.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
That's my, today that's my biggest job. I already did my call today. And there's always two or three every day.
Wow.
So, but it's just, that's a, I guess an ego for me that I don't want to let loose, that I just kind of want to be involved yet. And
you call every driver on their birthday and wish them a happy birthday?
Yeah. It's, I don't know. There's probably close to 800 drivers. And
wow.
And yeah, it comes up. It don't take me long. And, but I've did it for 10 years. It's, you know, it's little things.
Yeah.
That don't cost a lot of money. Some that means more to people than big. I go give a gift to somebody, but that phone call could mean more than a gift.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's little things, and we don't want to forget to thank those that's got us to where we are. Mm-hmm. You know, without them drivers, without all them employees, Don wouldn't be where he is today. I wouldn't be out here enjoying the good life here in Desert Shores Resort. And I need to thank them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with your commitment in Oklahoma, then I guess how much time do you have left on that term? And are you interested in continuing that relationship?
No, I was going to resign, and I went down and talked with the boys, and I said, you know, I'm kind of tired of airplanes and flying home every month. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you're going to partake and be, accept a position, which the commissioners are appointed by the governor,
mm-hmm.
and or the president pro tem,
mm-hmm.
You have to participate. You have to give back. You have to do work at it. Okay.
Yeah.
It's, and I feel that maybe at my age, it was time for me to step aside and let somebody younger in. And our governor's up for reelection this fall.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll try to stick out the term. Well, the boys said, to me, don't do that, Dad. Stay on. Let's see this illegal thing through,
mm-hmm.
and help us there. And he said, what if I paid and bought you a first class ticket back and forth for the meetings?
Mm.
Okay, I'll stay on.
So. Yeah. A little bit more comfortable. Yeah. Than hopping on Southwest or something. That's for sure.
Right.
Yeah. So, well, no, well, that's great, Don. Well, no, we appreciate all you've done in the industry and your continued involvement. And I think it is interesting. You're hearing that chatter. When we move ag machinery around, most of the guys, I don't have to go through Illinois, or you hear the same things about being, you know, different restrictions in different states. But we've really been hearing that up here. It's like, well, we got to get down to Texas. So that means we got to get our guys through Oklahoma. And I think that they're sending better drivers through your state. I think the reputation's starting to, at least there's a little bit of strength there where people understand that they're going to play by the rules if they run through Oklahoma. So I think what you guys are doing down there, it's well received in the industry. And I think that there's a lot of positives to come because of what you're helping to shape down in Oklahoma.
Well, and I hope it bleeds over. Thank you for that. I hope it bleeds over into a lot of our states. I see, I don't know, or Virginia or someplace, they just did a big shutdown and they got 80 some illegals off the road.
Mm.
So other states are stepping up. And shutting down these CDL mills, you know, California was a leader in that, but I understand that New Mexico and Washington and a few of these states that were kind of rogue on this,
mm-hmm.
have stepped up now and are shutting it down. We need to get our highways back safe. We need them to be able to read, understand English. We need we need our scales to keep operating, but it the scales really can't arrest or do anything. They can only write citations. So it's going to take ICE and the state patrol to do it. And today I give them, I commend them because they are doing it.
Yeah. No, it's good for the industry. And I think it's good for the whole. And, you know, you look at your just simple automotive insurance. I mean, everything's gone up. Insurance has become such a major hindrance in everybody's day-to-day lives. But, you know, potentially a lot of that could be attributed to all the fatal accidents and everything that's going on because of the demand. And you could blame a little bit with my wife, but, you know, we get so many packages every day now. It's just, it feels like Christmas every day at the Bosley household. And it's just, it's more so out of convenience. Well, what's the backbone behind all of that? Well, it's these over-the-road truck drivers. You know, it's these guys with these CDLs that, you know, there's a lot of risk as a driver. And I'm not talking about just even being an owner-operator, just being on the road and over-the-road trucker. You're gone from your family. There's so much sacrifice to make a good living and, you know, to keep your family fed. And we need these truckers in every bit of the same way we need producers in agriculture. And I think that just there's a lot of negatives right now in both industries. There's a lot of parallels.
Yeah. Well, and 100% right. By the way, agriculture and trucking kind of go hand in hand, and mm-hmm. always has. The drivers that we have today, our drivers, maybe a little one, but they haven't really seen a pay increase in 3 years because of this. Mm-hmm. We need to get back paying these drivers for what they do, for what they're worth. These drivers got a tough job with the traffic today, and we just don't need their livelihood affected because we got people out there that don't play by the rules in the same way we do.
Yeah, definitely. It's big risk for all sides, really. But, you know, again, the insurance really makes things trying and difficult. But hopefully with some of your efforts and what the great state of Oklahoma is a part of right now can really set the standard and get some of these other states, you know, whipped up into shape here, and we can make the whole environment for this industry, yeah, just a better place. And I think that's the goal, Don. And I think a lot of folks are grateful for all the things that Fry Miller's done as a brand and, you know, more of a family type of a feel of an operation. And I think that's reflected for anybody that's ever worked with you or had any sort of familiarity with the type of business that you guys have been running for so many years.
Well, I really appreciate that. And thank you for the kind words. You know, I've been blessed. God has looked over me and blessed me. But again, it's took all these people. And it hasn't been an I deal. It's been a we deal. And let's keep that going. And let's not let a few bad apples spoil the barrel. Okay.
Yeah, there you go. That's very well put. Well, Don, I think at this point, let's just wrap it up for today. Again, Don Frymiller here. You can go to frymiller.com. Is there anywhere else you'd like anybody that's been watching to go to, or any sort of action items for anybody that's going to watch this on the replay?
Well, if anything, and you got connections to people that can make a difference out there to help get this done, talk to your legislators, talk to your politicians, make your voice heard. It's the people that can get this changed, and it's the voice of the people that can help do this. So speak out, help us get this put to bed.
Awesome. Well, Don, I appreciate your time. Thanks for hopping on. Go ahead, Scott.
Don's wrote a book. If you're interested in hearing more about Don's story, he wrote a book. What year did you publish that book? It's called The Truckers Trucking Company, I believe, by Don Frymiller.
Building the Truckers Trucking Company.
Okay.
That book is, I don't know, 14 years old. There's a lot of outdated stuff in it, but it's kind of a story of my life going through this. All this, what I told you, is in the book. I haven't said anything that isn't in the book. The Books, again, a hair outdated. Mm-hmm. Numbers and stuff.
Yeah, well, no, we'll post a link to any sort of resources online to try to track it down and let the audience know where they can find it at least. So,
yeah, I believe it's still being sold on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah, no, yep. we'll post a link for the book and something. Yeah, if you got an audio book, see, when I'm farming, I need the audio. You know, Scott's out there; he's got his feet kicked up, and he's probably got a foot massager going. I know his 8R tractors are massaging his seat. He's a little bit more comfortable. If you got an audio version of the book, I'd love to listen to it while I'm trying to farm. But yeah, we'll make sure to post that link as well, Don. So, but no, great interview today, and really appreciate your time, Don. And for Scott Anderson, I'm Zach Bosley. Tractor Tuesday Live. If you haven't clicked the like or subscribe, make sure to do it. Saw a few people get the notifications that we went live today. We don't know when we're going to go live again. It will be on a Tuesday, but it'll be at our next guest's schedule. So we just make it work for them. So make sure you have those notifications set so you can get an alert when we're about ready to go live. But for Scott Anderson, Don Freimiller, Zach Bosley signing off here at Tractor Tuesday Live, and we'll catch you next time on a Tuesday.